The 82, because it was a night fighter as well. It flew a lot of night missions. And talk to us about that, because what was the logic behind that? A fast airplane, long range, and something that could fly at night to carry radar, I presume.
It could go from Japan to Korea, fight for a few hours, and go back to Japan for a warm bed. Mm, it was
like
an amazing long-range airplane.
And we saw more and more of that, didn't we, during this transition, guys? We saw range becoming critical. We hadn't transitioned yet into a real intercept fighter yet at this point. And I don't know, Stu, what, in your opinion, when was the first time we started thinking that way? Maybe with the 86 when we had the swept wing, or it wasn't an intercept per se.
Well, they call the Tiger Cat a fighter, but it was more of a night fighter. It could carry radar, it could carry
right.
two guys, so they had everything that they needed.
But the first jet to be considered in that class, maybe, I don't know, what would it be? What would the first true intercept be?
That's a question for you.
We'll ask the naval aviator over here.
So the Meteor, I guess, in that parlance, will be the first interceptor, because it was actually in 1943, it was put in to defend against the V-1 buzz bombs.
Fly up, pick the wing up on the buzz bomb.
Yeah, they would try to shoot it with their cannons that were notorious for a 420-millimeter Hispano cannons in there, and they would try to shoot it down with those because it's a lot funner, but if that didn't work, they'd pull up alongside and just tip the gyro on the buzz bomb and just let it go down into the English Channel at that point.
I mean, these are pioneer aircraft. It really, really, you have to think about, and I give pause, when you start talking about the 82, the Meteor, and the F-7F, and early jets. I know, Stu, you fly F-86s and all kind of stuff like that. We really were not that far away from the Wright brothers at that point. You know, just 50, 60 years at that point for some of those that you fly, and even earlier than that for the jet that you're flying here, Zach. What did we learn, do you think, was the most pivotal in that transition early on? What was the biggest lesson learned in these first 3 or 4 years of jets? Where do you think we really hit the stride with it?
I think they were some of the bravest guys I've ever met in my life to get inside.
Oh, yeah,
stuff.
Sure. But I mean, where did we really hit our stride technology-wise? What, in your opinion?
Once we started perfecting the axial flow motor, that really changed.
That was the game changer.
The first game changer was proving, well, the first major jump was when Whittle went from a single-side pump to a two-sided pump. That's and when I say pump, I mean the engine has two-sided centrifugal compressor with the Rolls-Royce Nain. The engine in the Meteor is actually the Rolls-Royce Derwent, and the variant is the 9 that's in the Meteor, the T7. But that Nain engine wouldn't fit. So they had to re-engineer and make one just a little bit smaller, and that was the Derwent, and that's what went in the Meteor.
And from there on, the technology just continued to progress.
Yeah, the amount of technology gains in that time was just phenomenal.
Well, because Tom's been working in this transition phase for now a number of years, what surprised you the most on the XP-82, engineering and technology-wise?
It was basically the same as a Mustang. The engineering was very similar to Mustang, with two complete full controls for both. But then, nothing was the same as a Mustang. It's hard to imagine that. But nothing worked the same. It had to be a completely new designed airplane, but using the same airfoil in the same basic engines, but 300 more horsepower, different propellers. And then the landing gear is completely different. Everything is mounted different. It looks like two Mustangs. That's as close as it gets.
So the difference in between the two, one of the most surprising elements for you, and I can throw this at you too, Zach, because you deal with so much of this. Anything surprised you along the way where you have sort of an aha moment when you're working on this thing and you go, oh, that's why they did that?
Well, if you ever flown or worked with old British electric equipment, you ask yourself why the hell they
did
that.
You mean Lucas, Prince of Darkness, right?
Lucas, and right. And if you've seen the layouts, not just in the Glossier is actually not bad, because they just robbed the Spitfire and put it in there, right?
All just
the,
a Spitfire cockpit.
Pretty, very close, I mean, same attitude gyro, same heading gyro. But the Vampire, the Venom, and a few of the other jets, you get in there and you have no idea how they flew it. The gear handle and flap handles are right next to each other, completely out of sight. And everybody wonders why they have so many gear up landings, and historically, it's just because you can't see the gear handle.
So. Well, you know, Marty must have thought this was important with the World Heritage Aircraft Museum that you fly for.
Yeah.
Why did he want to save this stuff, and why was he so insistent on getting this here, in your opinion? I know we can't, he's not here to answer.
Yeah, we both are very passionate about things that are very unique. We want to keep the history there. Not a lot of people know about the history of the Meteor, but when you see it, you touch it, you get to talk to the pilot and get to learn that it was a very pivotal aircraft during that transition and very important. He saw the significance of it. I mean, all of us being, you know, flying people, we understand the significance of it. But, you know, there's more than that. We also worked a lot with the STEM, with young children, to bring it in there. If you can show them, you know, have someone fly an F-5 and you have a Meteor right next to it, and you can show them the differences and talk through what technology and engineering does, and maybe get a couple of those guys interested, and they become our engineers and invent the next technology, whether it be some super, super fast airplane. That was kind of the goal, Marty's dream.
Well, I hope it continues too, because I know those jets are important. Yep. And you know, when you go to a museum and you see the lion in there, it's great. But when you go to the zoo and you hear it roar, you get it. I mean, it just becomes crystal clear what that animal can do. Stu, in talking about jets, you have flown some of the coolest airplanes that I know of. Talk a little bit about your experience in some of the larger stuff, because you can't talk about early jets and not get into Connie's and everything else. I mean, that was the pre-jet age of the airline, too.
Well, we moved Bataan a little over a year and a half ago. It had been parked for 22 years, and we had a crew up there, and it took us over 6 months to get the thing woke up.
And this is the former Air Force One. I mean, before it was called Air Force One.
Well, it was Bataan. It's a lot of history. A lot of history. MacArthur's airplane. And we woke it up. Three of them woke up okay. One said no. So we changed that engine. And then we changed that engine again. And we finally got one that would work. And it was very interesting. Everything worked. There was a few things on, you know, that we had to kind of mess with a little bit. And we had a good crew. We had a good engineer. Engineers are very important. We had one little issue where two and three quit, but we got them back pretty quick. So
you had two more. I mean, what's
the problem?
We had
two more, so we're okay. You know. But the thing ran flawlessly all the way from the Grand Canyon to Chino.
And, remarkable story.
It's under full restoration now, and hopefully year two, it'll be done.
We were hopeful that we'd have Steve Hinton here to join this panel, but Steve's away flying.
He was doing a movie over there. Steve and I are the ones who moved it from the Grand Canyon.
Sure.
So it was really cool.
Yeah, there were so many Connies moved that year, and
there was two.
I know. Well, yeah. The first Air Force One.
Well, see, we borrowed two engines from them,
right?
And we moved ours, and then we took two engines off ours, gave them back to them, and they moved theirs.
They moved it over here,
and that's the way it worked.
Well, the reason I bring that up is that aircraft, as great as it was, it was no 737. I mean, but that was the top of the technology back then.
It was.
Before we got into the jet age of airliners.
No, it's nothing like what we have today, but it's got a cool factor that's unbelievable.
That's right. What do you want folks to know about this transition? I'll put it to Tom first. We'll work our way down the line. What do you want folks to really take away about the transition period between early jets and piston fighters and transports? What's the key takeaway here from that time period?
American technology, how quick it developed from fabric airplanes, wooden fabric airplanes, 1930s to the 1950s to supersonic. It's amazing how fast.
It is amazing. You can do it here.
It was 30 years worth of advancement in 10 years.
That's remarkable. And Zach, on your end?
I'd like, because kind of our theme with the British aircraft, I would like to let everybody know how important that alliance between England and the United States was, and all those technologies, Frank Whittles and all of our engineers working together to come up with machines that would give us the edge to end the Second World War and hopefully mitigate the rest of it. It was a huge jump in technology.
What about you, Stu? You want to add anything to that?
The one thing I'd like to see more young people involved in this, because the A's, well, you know, we're getting on up there, and we need more young people involved in it. So any way you can, any way you can get them involved and help them, I think that's really important to keep these things going.
Well, Tom will certainly start them off working. If a young folks want to come out, Tom's the guy to go see. Just go down and ask him. Zach, what do you mentioned the museum and the STEM activities. Is that the plan, I mean, for these Jets to continue to teach that message, I guess?
It was a piece of it, you know. Like you said, be able to touch, feel, and hear and see the airplanes fly hopefully will drive the next generation to come talk to us, see us, and hopefully after they see that they can be involved in such cool things, whether it be a Tiger Cat or a Meteor or whatever. The goal is just to get that, our next generation.
Well, God bless you guys for doing that. And I know Marty's family's around, and we appreciate them making the effort to get the aircraft here so we can all enjoy it. And we had friends here from England that saw it fly, and they said, wow, we haven't seen that since we were home. And here in the U.S., we have such a prolific collection of British aircraft, the English Electric Lightning that's being restored down in Gulfport, that hopefully someday will be here. There's a huge collection of not only English, but also American jets. We're seeing more and more of this, aren't we, Stu?
Yeah.
Of the jet age coming into fruition. Maybe, I don't know if Tom will ever restore a jet. That'd be kind of neat.
Probably not.
Tom has a story about a Top Fuel, I guess, really alcohol car that he discovered. That's practically a jet, Tom. You might want to jump into the jet business someday. You'd do well with an afterburner.
Probably.
I think you would. I think you'd need one.
I'll stick with the Top Fuel car.
Well, one of these years you could put two B-25s together with a jet engine under them. That'd be neat. What do you think we're going to see more of? I mean, that's the big topic here. As we transition and we talk about the transition between early jets, the Warbird movement is sort of following that some 50 years down the road. We're seeing more and more of these vintage jets. What are you hopeful that we see, Stu, in the coming years?
Well, you know, really we're doing pretty well this year. We've got 7 flyable Tiger Cats in the U.S. right now that are flyable. We've got one that was converted to a dual control. So we can teach people how to fly the thing. We've got everything in the back that we need. The only one in the world.
What did the T-28 play in this time period? And I'll throw that at you because I know it was designed to fly very similar to a jet and teach really that earliest of aviator what it was going to be like in a jet, but not be a jet yet. And we're seeing a lot of T-28s come online too right now. Zach or Stu?
T-28s have been around for a long time, and you know, that was the first step. But it's a real simple airplane. It's easy to fly and everything, but the cockpit's kind of laid out like an F-86, if you look at it.
Yeah,
so
that's what you'd always hear.
You know, stepping these guys up.
So the F-7F, a good gateway drug into flying jets, I guess, huh?
The F-7F is really the first airplane that was kind of thought out about how it's laid out, and it's really comfortable, and it just fits real well.
You make me want to go fly. Do you offer test drives?
Come on, let's go.
I'm ready right now. We'll drop it and go. I know we have a lot of questions out there. We have a great concert for you tonight. Chris and Dave Hatfield are here to sing for you. He's an astronaut. Recorded a little YouTube video up there in space, became pretty famous for it, and he's gonna sing and play here tonight along with his brother Dave, who's a Spitfire pilot.
Yep.
How about that? We ought to put him in the Meteor and see how he does.
He'll probably do very well.
Let's open it up to some of our crowd here tonight. We can talk XP-82 tonight. We can talk Meteor, and we can talk Tiger Cats and early jets with Stu Dawson, or whatever else Stu wants to talk about tonight. Do we have any questions tonight from anybody out here as we wrap up our compressed schedule tonight to get in the night air show? Anything out there? Any takers? We have someone will stand up and ask a question, and then we'll have 15 more that'll follow right away. Yep. Let's see. Any brave souls that want to know something tonight from these individuals? I know one. The airplane, the XP-82, you get asked this a lot. It's not for sale, but everything has a price. Is that fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else out there? Or we're going to wrap things up here, going once, going twice. Sold to the highest bidder. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Come back and stay with us. We're just a few moments Just a few moments away from the start of our concert. We're going to give the guys some time to come out here and get set up. And tomorrow night, I'm telling you, tomorrow night, if you come back right here for Theater in the Woods, 50 years from now, people will still be talking about the fact that we had all of these guests gathered up on the stage tomorrow night. Some of the coolest innovators and test pilots that are currently flying today will be here tomorrow night. And then Saturday night, the night of the tanker, is going to be a lot of fun. So come back and join us for the next three nights here at Theater in the Woods. You'll be glad you did. My thanks again to Stu Dawson, to Zach McNeil, and of course to Tom Riley for being here tonight, everybody. And thank you. We'll see you back here tomorrow night for another show.